seems like a lot longer than it really was. I just missed the one time here. I thought of you all so much on Tuesday night. It was a kind of traumatic time, Tuesday. There was a murder-suicide in downtown Willits that day at noon. And so I had my hands full in a way. Most of us were down there. We'd gone down for lunch and just after it had happened. And it's strange when something like that happens in the middle of sitting. You already have a context for it, but then it's always a question what our reaction is, how much of it's automatic and how much we can bring up into practice the effect, our way of being with it. I shocked everyone because I talked about it a little bit and ended by saying no blame. And afterwards they said to me, "What do you mean no blame? You know, he shot her and then he shot himself." We were talking, in fact, I talked, every time I gave a talk, I talked in Willits, in Arcata for four nights straight, and 6 nights in Willits, and 1 night in Casper. And the subject was the 3 pure precepts all the way through, which includes, of course, all the precepts and the refuges and all of that. But mainly the focus was on not to do wrong, to practice right, is the way to purify the mind. Or embracing and sustaining right conduct, embracing and sustaining every good, embracing and sustaining all beings. Jane Jasper was with me and was a good resource because she liked Donna Lynn and Jane also. I've been exposed to more ritualistic practices and knows better than I how to bring up the resources that Zen has. So in this case, we chanted the Enme Juku Kanan Gyo many times and dedicated our services to the two people who had died, the bad man and the poor woman. Jane wrote a beautiful echo to go after the chanting, which included everything. All beings, including the forests that we were living among, and all the beings in the forest and the valley, and just created a sort of big picture for it all. So it was bigger than one would have imagined, a little town and a little sit. There weren't that many people, 7 or 8 people, but it felt very big. And it was a lot of sitting. And I had a very curious experience. After the lot of sitting, I was invited to go to Casper, which is a little tiny little town on the edge of the ocean. You can hear the waves crashing in the nursery school where we meet, a little wooden building with gerbils running around in their cages and birds peeping and little teeny chairs. And so I gave my talk there also about stopping all evil and practicing good. And before I went there, I stopped in Fort Bragg, which is close by, and it's a bigger town. There's an art gallery there that I wanted to see, and then just around the corner was a brand new restaurant that had opened up, and I thought, oh, I can get a cup of soup there. So I went in, and next to my table was a much bigger table with a family, mother, father, and two little kids, one very little kid. She must have been about 13 or 14 months old, walking but not talking yet. And I went off to the restroom, and when I came back, she caught my eye, and I caught her eye. You know the way that happens, when you just click. And there was a sort of laugh in her eye, and in mine too. It was wonderful. And I sat down, and I went on with eating my minestrone. And all of a sudden, she was right at my knee. She said, up, up. So I just swept her up, plopped her in my lap. She threw her arms around my neck. I threw my arms around her. It was like a reunion. It was like, oh, I haven't seen you for so long. It was like she was so close to where she came from. And it was a kind of fruit of Zazen that I felt close to where she had come from also. And it lasted for maybe a minute and a half. Big hug. And then she jumped down, ran back to her parents, and that was the end of it. Except she said goodbye when I left. It was so sweet. And so rejoiceable, rejoice-ish. It was very, very lovely. So I came back with those two images, you know, the two bodies lying in the bank's parking lot, and then this child. It's life. And what a mercy this practice is in the middle of life. That we don't have to be thrown by it. That we can meet it as it comes. Everyone sends their greetings. Three people in Arcata are coming down, at least three, to Jikoji in February. So the floating Zendo is floating, which is really nice feeling. So all is well. And I hear that we finished the Koban book last week. And so now we have Suzuki Roshi. I don't quite know how to do this study, and I was going to ask you if you all have some ideas about it. These are very short talks, but it's kind of funny to give a talk on a talk. So I'm not sure what you have in mind. And I thought we could discuss it a bit tonight and create some kind of plan. So I have some idea of where you want to go with this. It's an incredible book. People ask me often and often, what first book should I read about Zen? And this is always the one I recommend, always. And there are a jillion books out there now, when there were hardly any when this book came out. It was rare then. So I don't know how much you all have been thinking about this, but maybe you could share your ideas about it with me.
Does each talk have a topic?
Yes, they each have a heading, which is based on, it's actually a sentence out of the talk itself, is the heading of it. It says negative and positive, and then quote, big mind is something to express, not something to figure out. Big mind is something you have, not something you seek for. And then there are about 1-2.5 pages of text. Sometimes it's 3.5. So limiting your activity, constancy, mistakes in practice, God-giving, no trace, right effort, repetition. It's not based on any particular Buddha teaching. It's not like the six paramitas or the four noble truths, or you know, all those lists of things. They're just very informal talks that he gave in Los Altos. Yes.
I think it's a good idea to give the talk and a talk. It kind of shows us how, when we read our own stuff, how to make the talk on that stuff. So to me, it's informative.
Well, that's a good point, Sonia.
I mean, it might be clear, but still, it would be nice to see your spin on it.
Okay.
Which energy is part of the discussion of the book, if you can also relate to us your personal experience with the author.
I have very little experience with Suzuki Roshi. I was much too shy to speak with him, so I never did. And I only saw him 2 or 3 times, and only from afar. He inspired me very much. He's the reason I'm here, because he was the first one I ever heard speak about it. I was amazed. He gave the Dharma talk at Tassajara when we ended up there by accident, and they invited us into the Zendo, and I had been looking for I didn't know what until I met it in his words and his voice and his being. So he had a very profound effect on me, but I was much too shy to approach him. We returned the next year. He was still alive. He was not very well. He was wrapped up. He had cancer here somewhere, I think in his throat or somewhere, and wasn't well, and gave a very touching talk about the limits of life, and that again was very touching. And then that was the end of it, until several years later someone there, when I was again there just on vacation, asked if I knew that there was a Zen master 5 miles from my house, and that was Koban. So the talks that were given were in Los Altos, where I met Koban. But Suzuki Roshi was gone by then. But of course his flavor was all around, and his flavor is in all of his old students. You know, my dear friend Catherine Thanis was part of his world, and Blanche Hartman, a number of people who are still teaching and still around.
sense of the aspects of sitting or talks too.
That's true.
So perhaps if it's less than 3 pages, again, we can read them and discuss that one.
Yeah.
Share what stands out for you, or we can share what comes up for us. We just really did the aspects of sitting. You have more of a sense of what he was saying behind the words.
What Koban was saying. Well, he was a lot more mysterious than Suzuki Roshi, too, so. Yeah. Julian.
One possible idea, I don't know if this is a good one or a bad one, but since we have been talking about aspects of sitting, talks of Koban, we could start with part two, right attitude. Because the first part is about right practice. It goes into posture and stuff.
Yes.
And maybe after part two and part three, we go back to part one and talk about sitting again. You know, that's just an idea.
Well, that's a good idea. So it's not too redundant, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. Since we've done posture and breathing and all of those things. And begin with, what does part two begin with?
Right attitude.
Right attitude.
Well, that's the...
Oh, that's the whole thing.
The first part would be a single-minded way. Starts on page 52 in my edition.
And then the third part is right understanding. Traditional Zen spirit, transiency, the quality of being.
It's more like philosophical.
Yes.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Beyond consciousness. Well, that's fine. Let's do it that way. Start on page 53. That's a short one. It's two and a half pages. Right. Do we have time to do it now? We have 15 minutes. How shall we do? Maybe we should wait until next week. Maybe there's some questions you have about who knows what. That come up in practice or in what we've talked about Koban. We certainly didn't cover everything that was in that little Koban book. Or anything else. We still have practice period going on. So, are you shocked by the reminder?
I have a question about the no blame.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe speak more about that. Sort of. I think it's very intriguing.
Well, of course, we can easily blame. It was a horrendous thing to do. And it was very wrong and very bad. On the other hand, from the wisdom point of view, many, many, practically infinite number of causes and conditions came together to create that situation, far beyond those people. So from that point of view, from the bodhisattva point of view, which includes everything that's happening, you can't really blame one particular individual for what happens. we're all, in a sense, pawns of the life force and the many forces that are creating each situation as it happens. And they all keep coming together and coming together into various situations that sometimes are appalling. So on one side, of course, we say that was wrongdoing. And we try to stop wrongdoing. In fact, the fire chief was at the bank, in the bank, when he heard the shot. And he, many shots, I think he shot it, shot three times, and rushed out and was running toward the shooter. And the shooter turned around and aimed the gun at him. And then suddenly, at the very last minute, turned it around and shot himself instead. But you know, just all those forces in that tiny little parking lot, we could see, but the rest of it we couldn't see. And the first thing I said was, that was some mother's child. Who knows what kind of life and where that all came from, and where that kind of, and that came from, and that. All the way back. So we can be very sorry about something like that, but we can't really apply blame. That's why the precept says no praise or blame. You know, praising self and blaming others, because that's what we tend to do. Oh, I'm so clean, I'm so perfect, and oh, that bad person over there did this really horrible thing. But we really can't say so. You know, we're all in this together. And that was our brother. And a very sorrowful thing as well.
You make me think of a poem I just read by Sharon Olds, where she's thanking a teacher in sixth grade who had heard, to the story that Sharon Olds told the story in the poem, that she'd heard the reputation of Sharon that she was a troublemaker. And when she showed up in his teacher's class, she said, "I've heard about you, and you will get a hall pass to go to the library as soon as you finish your desk work." And so the poem is one of praise for Mrs. Krikorian, was her name, for recognizing in this student that what she needed. And she spent her year in the world of words, and we now have a poet who is extraordinary.
Oh, that was Sharon Olds' own story.
Yes.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then in the poem she said, you know, praise to Mrs. Krikorian for saving me, and praise to who saved Mrs. Krikorian.
Yes.
And I think it's the same thing that you, I mean, that's a story that really feels very true, and I felt gratitude reading about that story. And it seems that this practice is about not choosing. And if I want to trust in the causes and conditions that brought about Mrs. Krikorian, who were part of the causes and conditions to give us Sharon Olds, I can't say, well, I like those ones, but I don't like those things.
Yeah.
I can't do it. It's making up even more of a dream.
Yes. Yes. Oh, that's lovely about Sharon. So glad. Yeah. Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story like that, about two little boys who came to Plum Village, and he was showing them around, and he had just gotten a new printing press and a new cutter for making books or something, probably on the precepts. And the littlest boy wanted to, the both little boys wanted to see how it worked. And so he was showing them the buttons that you push. And he pushed one button, and the littlest boy pushed another button simultaneously and burned it up. Uh-huh. Just like that, the brand new machine. And the older brother said, "You always do, you always wreck everything. You're always ruining everything. See, he just did it again. What a terrible thing." And Tay said, "Well, it's okay." And then he said, "You know, I've got this cutting machine over here. It works the same way." And he said to the little boy, "Do you think you could learn how to do this the right way?" And he said, "Here's the button you push. Here's the button you don't push. Do you understand?" And the little boy said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay, now you try it." And he did it. And it was okay. And he said it just changed everything in the relationship between the two boys, because he had finally been able to prove himself in some way, redeem himself, because he'd been given the opportunity. It's one of the things we can all do for each other, and for any small being especially, is to give them the space and the trust. And Tay said afterwards, "You know, I wasn't entirely sure he wasn't going to wreck that second thing." He was a little afraid. There was something wonderful about chanting the canon chant, the Avalokitesvara chant. We never did it in Koban's time, but we have it now here and have done it several times. We did it last at the Seigaki ceremony. You always do it at the Seigaki ceremony. And you chant it slowly at first, and you do it seven times. And it's a kind of, an acknowledgement of the fact that compassion and wisdom, Buddha wisdom and compassion, arise everywhere in every single tiny moment. Nen nen, it says over and over again, the thought in philosophical Zen. A nen moment is, I don't know, an atomic number of small of thought. And those nen thoughts are running through us continually. And the chant says that every single thought that runs through us is a Buddha thought, is a compassion thought. So it's just bringing it up and expressing complete trust. Even in the face, and it's often chanted in the face of a death or a suffering of some kind. If somebody's sick, sometimes they'll dedicate a chanting of the canon chant to the sick person. And it comes out in the echo after it's chanted seven times, faster and faster and faster. Then the echo comes and dedicates it to so and so and so and so, and to the well-being of everybody in the universe. It's comforting. It goes faster and faster, so it's kind of a blast of, I don't know, Buddha juice or something. Mm-hmm. Well, we have two more weeks of practice period. I think that's right. Yes, it must be. Is it three?
It ends at the end of the Hatha, which is
It's the 8th. Yeah. So that's 1 week. Yes, it is 3 weeks. It must be, or 2.5. Yeah. So I hope you all are enjoying it and finding some ways of focusing on practice more. I know it's a very busy time, but a busy time can be a practice time as well, especially. You can be mindful in the middle of a Thanksgiving dinner. In fact, it probably helps to just be as present as possible.
Is there a, is there a chant for some Buddhist practice that we might bring, maybe a little bit under radar, to the table, to the Thanksgiving table? Like a gratitude or...
To do Oryoki.
When people ask me to say a prayer, I say the Oryoki, some of the Oryoki. Innumerable labors brought us this food. We should know how it comes to us, or we do know how it comes from. Receiving this offering, we consider whether our virtue and practice deserve it. Desiring the natural order of mind, to be free from clinging, we must be free from greed. To support our life, we take this food. To attain our way, we take this food. And then it gets more specific, so I don't say that part. But that's kind of a sort of non-Buddhist way of doing it. Well, it's 8 o'clock.